psychodynamic theory, and that was sort of my foundation. And then over the years, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years.
Yeah.
Over the years, as part of your ongoing professional development, you have to do continuing education, and I've been doing that for 40 years, you know, and it's required, but I've never felt like a burden. This is something I have to do. I'm always really glad to learn and keep up with the latest theories, and trained in different orientations, you know, from not only just working with people individually with more psychiatric type issues, but also ongoing training in coaching, like the coaching program that I did. It was specifically for clinicians. There are a lot of life coach training programs out there that, you know, basically, I mean, I don't even know if you have to have a bachelor's degree, but I would say most of them, probably the better ones, are probably at least have to have a master's to become a certified life coach, for example. But the program I went through was specifically for licensed professionals, at least master's level, if not PhD and MD, MD level. So you have that clinical training and background, but then you learn the skills of coaching, right, as opposed to counseling, because it is a different sort of set of skills. You know, you're not really trying to treat anxiety symptoms and depression and things like that. You're helping the client sort of focus on maybe a specific area of their life that they feel like they need help with.
When do you make the transition from advice, counseling, to medication?
Well, if I think typically I tend to sort of try counseling before going to medication, but it really depends on how the person's functioning. If a person is having really severe problems with, say, sleep, or appetite, you know, eating, loss of appetite, you know, if you're not sleeping and eating right, it's going to affect your mental health eventually. And I think some people are so severely depressed they're not getting out of bed in the morning, you know. You know, in that event, the person really needs some help to sort of get out of that, because it's not just a mental thing, it is a physical, physiological thing. They've done brain scans. A guy by the name of Daniel Amen has done, he sort of become famous for his brain scan work, where he scans brains of different patients and can actually see the difference in the scans between someone suffering from depression or anxiety or PTSD or drug abuse or ADD. You can actually see that there are different levels of activity in the brain from the scans. So when you may become clinically depressed because of circumstances and maybe a predisposition that may be there, but eventually it begins to affect brain chemistry.
Yeah.
And once that brain chemistry changes, well, that's when you really need some medical help to change the brain chemistry to sort of help the brain function more clearly, to make better decisions, and change their life as a result of making better decisions, being able to think through things better. Well, you got to be able to get up and get out of bed and go and go to work, or you know, if you want your life to improve.
Well, you say that too, because when I first came to you, I was going through some personal strife with just separating from my family and getting divorced and having young children, and I felt this overall just sense of responsibility that I was failing, you know, my kids, my family, even though I wasn't not in a good state, and it just wasn't a healthy spot for our family at the time. And I wasn't sleeping. I mean, maybe an hour and 20 minutes a night for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, I always think of myself as completely invincible. And once I get to the vaccine, I'm gonna be immortal, is what I'm deciding. But it was after about the 2 years, I was there was 1 or 2 days I was like, I was not well, and I don't think I met up with you yet. But my father's a neurologist, and he studies sleep medicine a lot. And I was kind of checking in with him. He's like, you're gonna probably have to take some medication to sleep, and then work from there. But he it's funny, as a neurologist, he was always anti-medication. We're gonna do whatever we can. To keep you off medication, because once you get down that rabbit hole, it's hard to come off of it.
True.
You know, and I see so many people now these days, the minute there's a sign of, you know, attention disorder or anything that is just not perfect, thrown on a drug, and then they're there for years. I mean, we've taken a lot of time to do a lot of internships. I've hired a lot of people, younger folks out of school, and the amount of folks that are still 25, 26, 27 taking a ton of Adderall every day just to go to the office is a lot. I mean, the majority, in my opinion, which is, it's an interesting, and I just don't know how healthy that is.
You know, I think, speaking of ADD, I would say it's probably the most misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, and overdiagnosed problem that exists, because it looks, it can surface as so many different things with different types of symptomology. So a person can be diagnosed improperly. For example, say a person's got anxiety symptoms, and you diagnose them with a generalized anxiety disorder, and you give them some type of anti-anxiety medication. But the reason they have so much anxiety is they have ADD. So the underlying issue is really ADD. Anxiety is a secondary system, symptom to having the disorder of ADD. So the proper diagnosis is absolutely important and critical. And then I think, you know, when you look at small children, young children that are getting diagnosed at an early age, sometimes I think they're getting diagnosed properly. Sometimes they're not, and then they get started on the medication, and they become dependent
young,
on
too,
it.
Right?
Oh yeah,
I mean, 8, 9,
first, second grade sometimes, you know, and a lot of it can be because due to hyperactivity, and some of it can be just due to just difficulty concentrating, not being able to focus, and that's, I think, where sometimes the difficulty can be so extreme that medications can be helpful. You know, I did some contract work at the College of Charleston and at Clemson University, and I saw it a lot. There were a lot of students with ADD who did fine in high school because they were able to sort of cope or rise above, or, you know, get through high school okay. Some even excel, but when they get to college and the load is, you know, so much greater, they hit a wall, and oftentimes aren't diagnosed with ADD until they're in college.
So I have a lot of listeners of this podcast that are parents that have children, let's say between 8 and college, you know. What advice, you know, and it's a perfect example for me. My son was at the soccer game on Saturday playing in a game. He must have saw 30 birds. You know, he was just bird watching while he was on the field. He had a couple great kicks, and I love him to death. But he, you know, he just wasn't that concerned about the soccer game. And he's 6, so it's fair. But, I mean, what are I specifically will do whatever I can to keep him off any medication for whatever I can do. What are some tactics you could take with a younger person to get to fight ADD or whatever the symptoms or the early signs? I mean, what are a way to get them? Because I imagine if you change the habits young enough, it probably helps a lot. Is what I suspect, but you're the expert.
Well, distractibility, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people say that ADD is really more of a modern day problem. Because in the earlier days, distractibility might have been a good survival instinct. Hunters, picking up on the slightest little sound or noise in the trees meant they ate that night.
Mm-hmm.
So what might be considered a weakness or a symptom might actually be a strength in a different setting. So trying to put young children in a classroom and expecting them all to sit in little chairs and at their desk and behave and pay attention to teachers, not be distracted by everything that's going on around them is pretty unrealistic.
It's fair.
You know, but I think oftentimes it's a big disparity, it seems like, between IQ and performance. When you know someone's got a high IQ, but they're just not able to perform at the level of their IQ because they're having difficulty concentrating, just cannot stay focused, can't read a paragraph without reading it three times.
Yeah.
You really begin to see that a child is motivated and trying hard to do the right thing, but they don't seem to have the capability of doing it. Their brain is sort of just not functioning at a level for them to be able to concentrate, like say dyslexia.
Yeah.
Dyslexia, it's a commonly well-known sort of reading disorder, and the area of the brain affected that leads to dyslexia also is very closely linked to the area of the brain of ADD.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes you'll see the two very close together, common symptoms of both. And so that's where the brain chemistry really does make a difference. I liken it to say a dimmer switch on your light there. You can turn it down 50% and you can read, but it's more difficult. But when you turn the dial on the switch and turn the intensity level up, well, then you can read a lot better. Things seem a lot more clear. That's the way it is, I think, with people who really do need medication and benefit from it. You may be able to function at 75%, but you might function a heck of a lot better if your capability is 100%. And so a lot of times I think you can, if you increase the capability of somebody, like the medication might increase the capability, then it becomes a matter of willpower.
Yeah.
Does the person have the will to sit down and try to read?
Sure.
You got to make a decision to sit down and read now that you've got the capability of focusing and reading.
It's harder to do in this day and age, too, with all of our... I mean, I've seen myself doing it. I've got 15 different things going on at all times, and distractions on your phone, and you talk to me about, I don't like to sit and just hang out. I mean, that's a big problem for me. I don't look at it as a problem. I'm just like, these are things I want to get done today.
Right.
So,
yeah. You're a doer.
Yeah, but it is. There's something to be said to just be able to sit and do nothing. I mean, that's a talent that I'm trying to learn more about. but it's, I think you just get so caught up in business and everything else that, the other thing I've learned about, sort of mental studies and health is, like, to be honest, everybody's probably struggling with the same thing. You think you're the only one that's ever faced this fact in your life. Nobody's ever felt like this. And you're probably like, lots of people feel like that.
Right, yeah.
But that is good to know. I mean, I think when I go back to this concept of stigma and mental health, and like, some people are like, I'm not going to go see somebody on this thing. Like, I'm not going to talk to somebody. I'm just going to mask it. Booze, whatever they're doing, drugs, or crazy exercises, or just keeping themselves busy, which works for a while. Works for people's whole life. For me, it worked for a while. I just kept super busy. And I was like, what are my fundamental issues as to why I would make these decisions? But I've also noted, and I've talked to folks about this as well, that are like, I probably should talk to them. Like, the fact that you're even thinking about wanting to examine yourself is impressive.
It is. It's a strength.
I view it that way.
Yeah.
Because most people don't, I would assume.
Yeah, well, I think there's been, like you said, there's been a stigma. You know, I call it the mental health double standard. You know, it's okay to have a physical problem and go to the doctor. But if you're not thinking clearly, or if you're in a really bad mood for any extended period of time, there's something wrong. And you probably ought to go to some sort of doctor, if you want to call it that, a counselor, someone that's trained in being able to help people that have either mental or emotional struggles.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in other words, be willing to say, you know, hey, you know, I'm not feeling like okay. I need to go get some help with this. You know, you try your best. I think, you know, we're sort of taught self-reliance, independence. Don't show your weaknesses, you know, especially men, you know, big boys don't cry, you know, and it's a sign of weakness, you know, always be strong. And so, you know, any type of mental struggle is seen as a character flaw or weakness. So folks, many people are just ashamed, you know, embarrassed to have a problem in the first place, much less go to a counselor, psychologist, psychiatrist to get help.
Well, that's part of the reason why I did this podcast, is because I want to emphasize to folks that I'm always working on trying to get better at everything. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. As I mentioned in your office a few weeks ago, I was trying to do everything right. And mm-hmm. you were saying, try to do everything right. But I've had this motivation my whole life to always try to improve or better myself, etc. But it's funny. I think I have a lot of people that listen to our podcast or do business with us, etc. That have that feeling. Like, I don't. I'm alone on this mm-hmm. project. I'm mm-hmm. an executive of a big company. You know, it's my problem. I got to just figure it out. And
oh, the executives in coaching, they're the loneliest because they're at the top. They don't have many people, if at all, to talk to. That's where I think so many of them really do benefit from having a coach. You know, somebody that's in their corner, nothing to win or lose, to help them look at some things that they need to sort of think through or look at without having to worry, you know, whether their company, people in their company might look at them as, you know, having a problem.
Do you think that, I would suspect given the pandemic, you probably are pretty busy these days for when people need someone to have something to talk to, some advice. I'm sure you do a lot of online Zoom stuff. Do you think that mental health and just the world you're living is being more accepted now, or is it going the opposite direction? I hear, you know, people in America say that this whole country has a mental health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, you're in the biz. You're probably pretty slammed, I would assume, with clients.
Yeah, so. Well, I think, you know, it has affected people mentally and emotionally, just being their lives turned upside down. And I think maybe more people are reaching out for help, not only because they're having more mental and emotional and relational problems. You know, I think a lot of husbands and wives, you know, and kids, all you know, under one roof, you know, working from home. Sometimes both partners. As well as trying to, you know, homeschool, parents that never had to confront anything like that before are all of a sudden put in the position of having to sort of like be teachers, you know, and struggling with, you know, this online classes and
right.
kids not doing well. And I mean, it's proven that the rate of depression and suicide and a lot of things have increased during this time period.
You mentioned you've been doing this your whole career, But I know you told me once that you had kind of an inflection point when you were a young man, that kind of maybe you were a little had a lifestyle that you didn't necessarily want, which I've had that lifestyle. I think I had a similar lifestyle. It was probably too much, having too much fun, going out, doing too much. And then I just started like, I better get work. Luckily, I found this career of money management and investments, and it's just been great for us because we get to see the transactions, and I've enjoyed it. I'm fortunate because I've only had one career, which is, unique in this society.
Yeah, I'm lucky in that respect too. Very lucky.
But talk about that stage of your life where you decided you wanted to focus on mental health and help, and doing things for others.
Yeah, that was quite a change. I think I was interested in marine biology initially. That's why I ended up in Charleston, College of Charleston Marine Biology Program. And for about 3 years, I was convinced I was going to be the next Jacques Cousteau. And
Cool gig, though. I mean, they get a submarine, which is always like something to aspire for. So.
well, when I finally faced reality that, there are not very many jobs like he has, and that I probably wasn't going to get one. I started thinking about what would I do if I, didn't pursue that career. And I found myself in a sort of in a group of people and a situation where I had a lot of people sort of turning to me for advice, and found my kind of a role as a teacher. And sort of lay counselor, and started thinking about becoming a counselor, and changed my major slightly, went from marine biology to just biology, so I didn't have to take quantitative analysis in organic.
Yeah, organic chemistry is always the deal breaker. Like that's
Oh
what
boy.
got me out of medicine. I was like, all right, I'm done with
Yeah.
this chapter of life.
Well, I couldn't handle the math side of chemistry, algebra. And, I was just a little too slow. I flunked 10 straight quizzes in chemistry because I couldn't finish them. Not
Ooh.
because I didn't know how to do them, but because I couldn't finish them. I found out I was ADD, and that's why. Nowadays, I would probably have been accommodated and given more time to finish the exams, and I probably would have aced them all.
Well, thank goodness that wasn't an option back then.
I'd be
We
dangerous.
wouldn't be here right
Yeah, I mean, I think, I switched majors and started taking some psychology classes my junior and senior year. To have enough prerequisites to get into grad school in counseling. And right after I graduated from college, pretty much about a year later, I started grad school. It's in a 2-year master's program, and after I completed it, moved back to Charleston. Worked in a clinical situation for 1 year and then went into private practice and have been in private practice ever since.
Yeah.
It's unusual to be in one career your entire life,
Has the
like
field
we have been.
itself? It seems like the things I've read and studied, and there's a lot of controversial positions. I mean, some people say the exactly opposite things, which I find interesting in this particular career. I mean, you seem to have a set of beliefs that maybe not align with other people's beliefs in your field, but maybe that's come together a little bit more in the last 10 or 15 years. But for a while, I thought there was a big, there could be a variety of ways to solve someone's problems, and
Yeah.
I don't know
Well,
if that.
say for example, do you take more of a sort of psychoanalytic, psychodynamic approach to looking at problems, or strictly behavioral psychology versus a more psychoanalytical, psychodynamic view, medical, and cognitive behavioral therapy focuses on more of the here and now and how your thoughts affect your emotions, rather than going into a lot of depth about background and family and those kinds of things that the Freudian psychodynamic approach tends to focus on. They generally are more like more long-term therapy versus a more brief form of therapy. And, you know, so I was trained in the more psychodynamic theory initially. And then it's interesting how much the industry managed care as far as mental and physical health influence things, because the insurance company started limiting the number of sessions that they would pay for.
Right.
So all of a sudden, we were faced with coming up with briefer forms of therapy. And so that's where I got my training, or when I got my training in CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and solution-focused therapy, because they tend to be briefer, you know. Eight to 10 sessions.
So the industry went to, this is how many hours you can have in a month or a year?
Right.
What was that transition?
Oh, wow. Back in, I would say the 80s.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So it's been around.
And it's gotten tighter and tighter, you know, where I think early in my career, you know, it wouldn't be unusual for someone to allow, you know, 50 sessions, you know, once a week for a year if needed, you know. And then it went, you know, cut back to, you know, like maybe 24, and then down to 10 or 12, you know. Now it's maybe 6 or 8 sometimes, you know. So it's, sometimes you have to, they'll give you a certain number of sessions, and then you have to justify additional sessions. So you have to write reports and, you know, that kind of thing to someone to look at and approve additional sessions.
Yeah.
So the paperwork of insurance and stuff like that really increased during that time period. And you know, but I think the training was I think the training in CBT on top of what I'd already obtained was really helpful. I find that many people respond to the CBT approach because it is more focused on the here and now and more practical, and it makes sense. It really makes a lot more sense to people than, say, a psychodynamic, longer term, more like deeper insight oriented type of therapy.
That makes sense.
You know, you focus more on the here and now. Like people can understand that, hey, you feel what you think. You know,
I was just getting ready to go to these quotes. Okay, so you're already getting ahead of me. I was going to read off a bunch of quotes, but yes, I want to know, are these Kentisms, as I say to my family? Are they? So that is the first one. I mean, is that your own quote, or did you read that in a book?
Well, it's the cognitive behavioral therapy belief that our thoughts lead to feelings that lead to behaviors. And it's a circle, you know. So thoughts lead to feelings that lead to behaviors. So if you're having problems behaviorally, look at the feelings underneath. What are the emotions that might be contributing or causing you to have some behavioral problems? And then look at the thoughts that you're having that are causing those feelings, those emotions. So you can have self-defeating thoughts, cognitive distortions, stinking thinking, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
But you know, you can look at any situation, and you can find a helpful or unhelpful way to think about it. No matter how terrible the situation may be, I just look at it as, no matter how bad it is, there's a helpful and unhelpful way to look at it.
No, and I've learned to embrace that a little bit more. I mean, as a money manager and somebody in this business, like, you know, just being in the financial advising business, 93% fail out in 3 years. So when I got in the business, I was like, okay, so 7% are going to make it. I'm like, whoever's left of that 7% is going to do pretty well. So I was doing whatever they were not, the other 93% were not doing, whether that was cold calling late or whatever the case would be. And I've always had that kind of thought process, is like, be on the other side of the trade. If everybody's up here buying, I'm selling. If everybody's selling, I'm buying. So I always look at this as, okay, everything's way down. That's a huge opportunity. I think, like, example would be New York real estate right now. Not doing so great, you know. Is it going to be that way forever? So we're starting to kick around the idea of looking in New York again for some things. The prices have gone down a tremendous amount. But
right.
When I came, started talking to you, I don't think my mind was at the clarity level that it was for most of my career. And now I see myself always taking the opposite side. And that's really just a thought process when somebody's like, oh, this is an issue. I'm like, well, look at the opportunity that gives you.
Mm-hmm.
And it has changed my optimism, my life, the way I treat people, etc. So I cracked that up to your quote, though. I'm not going to, it doesn't sound like it's referenced in any particular book. You just put a couple things together. So,
well, that just makes sense to people.
It does.
You know, to most people, I think they can get the connection between, well, if you're thinking negative thoughts, you're gonna feel negative, sad, depressed, anxious, and well, if maybe you can change the way you're thinking about something to something more realistic or something more constructive, if you can just change that thought, well, you'll feel better, and then your emotions, better emotions, feeling emotions, helps you to act better, do better, make better decisions.
Well, that if is a big if, though. Just as a reference point from a patient standpoint, I mean, that is self-talk. It's not, hey, you know, I tell people now that I play golf with or tennis with that hit a bad shot and throw a fit. I'm like, well, if you're going to throw a fit for making a bogey, then you need to have a party if you make a par. And they're like, okay, that's fair. You know, I don't see, I'm like, those, you just don't make pars. You just don't. You're not a par golfer. But it is a way to, I mean, it took me a long time to just talk differently to myself. Okay. Yeah. And then also have constructive daily schedule, you know, fill up your day with things to do, accomplishments that you did for the day.
Yeah. Well, I think everybody ought to get a list of the 10 cognitive distortions.
I have written down.
Because, you know,
these are, I think these anybody are and everybody. Don't tell me somebody else, you read this somewhere. This is, I thought you created all this.
Oh, yeah.
No, yeah. I think here's another, recovering perfectionist.
Yeah.
Canism, or is it a, you read that somewhere.
I'm quoting Dr. David Burns.
Okay.
He is a world-renowned cognitive behavioral therapist, researcher, writer, author, trainer. Says he is a recovering perfectionist. I did some training with him up in New York, and great guy. But, you know, I think perfectionism, you know, creates a lot of anxiety and depression because you have such high, unrealistic expectations. And so it creates anxiety to sort of try to be perfect. And then when you're not, you get depressed. So, you know, I think I may have told you he had to come up. He was a perfectionist, and he had to come up with something to replace that way of thinking, because he didn't want to be mediocre. He wanted to be, you know, the best he could be. So he came up with a replacement thought, the healthy pursuit of excellence.
Fair enough, yeah.
See, because excellence, there's room, pursuing excellence, there's room for human error and making mistakes. And the difference is you try to learn from them rather than looking at them as terrible, awful things, signs of failure and weakness. You just look at them more realistically. Okay, I didn't think about that. You know, I learned something. What can I learn from the mistake here so that next time I don't make the same mistake? That's pursuing excellence.
Yes.
Healthy pursuit. You're always seeking it. You don't ever get there.
We golfers
have this. It can always be better.
We golfers have this problem.
Ooh.
I was perfect on Friday until the last hole.
And that's all you'll think about.
That's all I really remember now. So I think that's why I love that sport
being,
so much.
Being a recovering golfaholic myself, I can relate. Yeah, you know, golf can really be cruel.
Yeah,
cruel sport.
Mostly, it's pretty much cruel all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel so much better when I see these guys miss 1 and 2 foot putts.
That's funny.
You know, just like me.
Well, I did bring you a chart. This is my report card of me, okay, that I wanted you to see, which, you know, back in the early days of our chats, you gave me a contentment exercise, which, mm-hmm. you know, I love spreadsheets. It's part of my life. So I put the 10 column, or 8 columns, I think it is, down 1 to 10, and I started charting it since 2000, let's see, April 22nd, 2019.
Right.
So here's the results. From left to right, as of this morning, I took it this morning. I just want you to know. So it looks a little bit better on a graph, right? I mean, numbers don't really matter, but I just graphed the net figures of all the categories added up. And so, I mean, you would, you know, as the one that created this rejuvenance, you get, you get an A for that, right? Pretty good about it. So you can hang that up in the office, put it on your website, be like, Joe. 2 years. Actually, it's been 2 years, which is pretty interesting. Yeah. So, but I do want to invite everyone that listens to this to take this contentment exercise, and they can contact me at my company. I'll just send them the list.
Yeah,
and then, you know, sort of certainly contact you as well. Yeah. But, you know, it was a nice, one of the things I tell people when I think my story is interesting because everybody always seems that everything's just perfect in my life and it's all easy and gravy and it's just, I just make a killing and everything's just awesome. And I probably present that attitude because I do feel really good about life in general, but we're also, you know, we have a positive outlook on our investments. We try to do the right thing, but there's a ton of work that goes on behind the scenes to get me from, I guess I started at 24 on the net figure to 73 today. You were a big part of that. But one of the things I tell people is you need to measure where you're at right now. Because I don't remember how I felt in April of 2019. I mean, I think I kind of remember some of it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I don't think it's really realistic to realize how you were thinking 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So the contentment exercise I recommend people do.
Well, it's just a way of sort of taking stock and seeing where you are in the areas of your life that you'd like to see improved.
Yeah.
You look at it sort of as a gradual process. You know, you don't go from a 4 to a 10. You know, improvement might be from a 4 to a 6 to an 8
right.
to a 10, you know, over a period of time. And I'm sure that's probably the way it was for you. You know, you were in a pretty
24 to 30 was the first move, so then 30 to 31. Took a while to get from 31 to 33, but that's another one.
And I noticed there are kind of some ups and downs
there. There was a down moment there, too. But well, that was the other thing I was going to say is, I mean, I and it's like my golf pro I interviewed last week. This is never going to end. I mean, I got to be here for life. I mean, that was the other thing. There's no championship at the end of this mental practice that we're working on, which is great news for you. You got unlimited amount of patience. But.
Well, like I said, healthy pursuit of excellence. You know, you're in pursuit. You know, that score can be higher because there's always room for improvement, right?
Well, it can only get to 80, so, you know, we got 7 points left. But I feel like that's going to take most of the rest of my life. So.
why is 80 the top?
Because 10. There's only 8 categories. 10 is the biggest number. That's the scale you gave me. So.
Uh-huh.
But maybe we make it 1 to 20.
eight is great, but I'm just curious. Why do you stop at 8 instead of 10?
Well, those are the 8 categories you gave me. So.
Oh, you mean the eight different profiles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you meant
family,
like
you know, health. There was these 8 different categories, 1 to 10. But I pass along to a lot of people. But I do want to say, Kent, it's, you know, obviously having you around as a friend and a guide and a mentor and a mental coach and all that has been great for me. It's been great for my family, great for my clients, my listeners. I certainly, when I came into this endeavor, I had a stigma about, I don't need help. I don't need anybody's advice. I'll figure it out on my own.
Yeah.
That was a pretty poor way to live the first 43 years of my life. So,
yeah,
I encourage anybody that is not even if they're struggling, just wants to learn a little bit more about themselves, is to find people that are influential and have been through a lot and have learned. It certainly helped me, and I appreciate all you've done. And I guess I'll be here for a long time. I feel like I was making progress too.
Yeah.
But thank you for joining us today. I really do appreciate that.
My pleasure.
All right.
My first podcast.